From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, apart from Monday, when we caught a few glimpses of Hillary Clinton at President Obama's inauguration, we really haven't seen or heard anything from her since she suffered that concussion last month. But today, as many of you are aware, she is center stage, full force. She's been facing tough questions this morning from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the assault on the United States diplomatic mission in Benghazi. That assault, of course, that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. Joining me to go over today's testimony are Juliette Kayyem. She is a national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe, and Charlie Sennett. He's vice president and editor of a Global Post. I guess we could have anticipated and expected fully that this would be very partisan. It was almost at the point of being a little bit ridiculous, kind of more nauseating on the part of the Democrats, if you ask me, because each and every one of them took an opportunity to praise her long and storied career and wish her well and say that she was great to have her back after her concussion last month. But the Democrats did not ask as tough questions as the Republicans did. And a couple of Republicans, while they may have crossed the line, I felt like, get your reaction to this, I got more information, big basic information from the questions asked by the Republicans because they actually narrowed her down on very specifics. Charlie?
Well, I thought I agree with you that this was a clear partisan dividing line right down the middle. It reflects the country at a very divided time in the nation's history. But I thought Hillary did an amazing job.
She was fantastic.
I thought she was. I thought she needed.
She was. You know.
Well, I thought she needed to be not senatorial but presidential.
She was.
And that is probably where she wants to head, right? So I thought she was extraordinary in cutting right through that partisan static and you know, that sort of distorted sound. She said to, I thought particularly to Senator McCain, who came at her, as he always does, as a bulldog.
Well, first he praised her up and down, and
then
he came after her.
Well, sort of. But then he said, look— And he got right into the heart of the questioning, which was just on the tape there, which for his thing is that 7 hours went by without a Defense Department asset. Two Americans were killed in the last hour. How is that possible? And I thought when Secretary of State Clinton said to him, I know you're emotional about this, and I know that Ambassador Chris Stevens was a dear friend of yours and of mine, I thought she shifted the table.
Yeah, she did. And she got mad. His jaw was locked.
Well, she basically took, as a woman who's been, as all sides agreed, a very effective Secretary of State, she made the lead Republican look shrill and emotional. Yet she embraced his question. She took it seriously, and she did her best to explain it. Now, I thought it was it really went to her strength as someone who really has maybe a more bipartisan gift than the president himself. And she went right into that sort of the lion's den of that great partisan divide and came out on the other side with I thought, taking full responsibility, adequate explanation that this was a security failure, and turned the tables effectively in saying, look, there was a $1.4 billion budget request so that we could improve security, including $500 million for Marine guards that you rejected. And as a result, yes, there are some problems with security, but it can come down to funding. Where's the funding? The State Department has been hollowed out a lot, as has often been reported. You know, there are more personnel in the military bands than there are in the Foreign Service. Mm. That's outrageous on its own.
Yeah, Juliette, I thought she was very, very strong on the timeline, on when they read what cables when, what kind of information they were receiving. She stuck to what she said originally about she didn't use the word terrorism, but she said, you know, an attack by unknown, you know, I can't remember exactly what her phrase was. But the issue that kept coming back to kind of haunt the administration, not so much Hillary Clinton, was over this putting Ambassador Susan Rice out on the Sunday morning talk shows. And Secretary of State Clinton said, well, you know, I didn't know who was going to be put forward, but I later heard Jake Tapper on CNN say, well, that was totally a White House call, and that she came armed with these talking points. But the bigger issue was, why were those talking points redacted? Why were they changed? Why were certain things eliminated that, was it because of national security or was it because they wanted to mislead the public? And that was sort of where that was heading, Martin, when we ended at about 11:40 today.
Right. And I think there was no resolution on that point. I mean, there is a lot of intrigue about why the White House would send Rice out in front, and some speculation were they trying to give her a more prominent role in anticipation of the Secretary of State designation. I think that is, to quote Hillary Clinton, who I also thought did fabulously, was, to say, does it really matter at this stage?
Does it matter? That was one point where she really got emotional. What does it matter? What difference does it make?
At this stage, and I thought, was it a good or a bad hearing? I think it depends on what you title the hearing. And so the Benghazi hearing that we all anticipate on getting, I thought fell into the partisan. I thought Hillary rose above it. McCain looked. I wasn't so shocked by some of the anger of McCain and Rand Paul. That's sort of their MO in these hearings. But if the hearing was about the State Department within the federal government and the State Department as a diplomatic tool or as a tool of foreign policy in a world where we're now worried about. What's happening in Algeria, Northern Africa, or Libya. I thought that part was really engaging, mm-hmm. and everyone played very well. So if you wanted the sort of, Hillary Clinton, this is my swan song, here's what's wrong with the department itself, her department, here's what's wrong with Congress. And guess what? I mean, I'm writing my column for tomorrow, but, when she says, let's just be honest, I mean, the world is kind of wacky right now. I mean, not to paraphrase her, but that let's be honest, the idea that we can predict, do we go into Libya and the consequences are, the hostage taking in Algeria, flowing through France's intervention, who knows? And I sort of appreciated that part, and I thought it lost its partisanship. And so if I sound, sort of a geek on bureaucracy right now, I thought that part of the hearing, so if you wanted to retitle the hearing, really educational really interesting to watch.
The duties of the Department of State, I agree.
Yeah, and her own, I mean, one of the senators said this, and I thought, for those of us who've worked in government too, she says, look, I'm here for a short period. This bureaucracy lasts a long time. Here's how you can help so that people like me will have more ability to drive an entrenched bureaucracy that has all sorts of problems. This is true of any bureaucracy. And she listed them off. And that was just sort of a lesson in, political management and political appointments and bureaucracies and their relationship with Congress that I thought was you don't hear very often. And I did not anticipate it here. I've thought Benghazi was just a creation of the campaign.
The other real sore point, Charlie, has been this whole thing about the request for additional security at the post in Benghazi. And my phrase, not hers, she says it's really not in her wheelhouse. These security requests are handled by Defense Department, other, national security. She wouldn't have seen those requests. It just wouldn't have. Even if it had come to the State Department, she likely wouldn't have read them because she used the phrase millions of cables and this kinds of thing that comes down. But it just wasn't her purview.
Yeah, I think that was the smart thing for her to say. I do think, however, the State Department culture from the Bush administration to today fails to read the cables. There are incredibly gifted people who work for the State Department who know the ground truth of what's happening in the world. And I have met with many of them in many of the places that are in question here throughout the Middle East and in Pakistan. And the frustration on the part of the ground troops with not being able to convey the reality to a State Department that's caught up in the political maw of everyday life in Washington, and the incredible traveling, which this Secretary of State has done, that there is a distraction there that cuts across not just this administration, but also the Bush administration. And one of the lessons is the great peril in not really listening to the ground truth. This is, this is the name of my blog, Ground Truth, and I believe in it. I believe that people who are on the ground know stuff.
But can't every company in business say that, Charlie? It's always like, listen to the
people. No, you know what? That's a great point. That is absolutely true that every business could say it. Good businesses listen to it. Mm. And it's about time the State Department started thinking of itself like a good business. You know, like, how are you going to get the most effective information that can lead you to make the best decisions possible? Part of it is to do the work of listening to the people who are there. And I do think that's a fair line of questioning for the Secretary of State. I thought she handled it well. Another interesting one where she similarly handled herself very well was when the question came about so-called arms coming in through the annex.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, I think you should direct that question to the agency that was
she
running
didn't know
the
what
annex.
Was, he was talking about. He said something about Turkey, yeah, and maybe he didn't know what she was talking about.
She effectively made the senator who was asking those questions, a Republican, look a little bit nutty. And then she said, "Ask that's a CIA operation, sir," in other words, without saying it, because she's not supposed to say that.
Right.
The one senator, not that I'm picking on the Republicans, but John Barrasso, I don't know exactly where he's from. Where is he from? And it doesn't matter. He made the comparison of what happened in Libya to the Challenger in hindsight, you know, saying that could we have prevented it? Should we have known? And he was saying we probably should have known. I thought actually that was a reasonable approach.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, actually, the Challenger disaster is used in business schools and public policy schools throughout the nation as sort of, okay, knowing what we know now, looking back at the decisions, the flow of information, the you know, are people reading the cables? What can we do to go forward? And it made systemic changes at NASA. This is the same thing that Hillary Clinton is trying to push through through the State Department. And so, you know, sort of consistent with her, what does it matter now? Point is if you know, let's drive these reforms for the next secretary, who she never mentioned by name, but of course we know he's appearing tomorrow.
He's going to be there tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. And learn from it, and figure out the information. And on this point, on these other agencies, I mean, what Clinton was trying to make clear is that the State Department is a client of the intelligence agencies, whether it's the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA. And part of the push that she was making, and remember, she basically went through every country at some stage and sort of said, here's this embassy and that, is that that the relationship between the intelligence gathering agencies and the client, which is essentially the State Department, has to be stronger. And I think that's a key takeaway. And she sort of alludes, like, look, we were really good on Benghazi after the fact because we all worked together and we knew that we were in a crisis and it was in the middle of a campaign. She sort of essentially admits that they knew they had a political problem. But how do you, you know, how do you keep that going? And she mentions Afghanistan with the withdrawal of troops and then, of course, Iraq, where there was another bombing today with 20-plus dead. So I thought that was really a valid and valuable point, that if we're going to put the State Department out there and they are not creators of intelligence, we don't put them in that role, they absorb intelligence, they're out talking to people, these cables that we're talking about today, then how do you make them better recipients of intelligence so that then she's able to act on it, she or her deputies or whoever's next are able to act on it. And I think it's clear that intelligence sharing and flow are flawed and hopefully will get fixed.
Going back to John Barrasso just for a second, who's a Wyoming senator, by the way, his comparison, you know, the O-rings and all that and what we should have known about how they work and they would be too, you know, there was a temperature too cold for them. He was saying that we should have had, Charlie, I have you address it. We should have had military guard, not just at the outpost in Benghazi, but all of our embassies, all of it. That has to have, so that there is a way to respond when something like that happens.
Yeah.
Is that feasible even?
It is feasible. And it's a very legitimate concern to have brought up. There should have been better security at that consulate. And that's not in dispute. I mean, I think that's why Secretary of State Clinton is saying, I take responsibility for a security failure. It's a security failure. We did not predict on the anniversary of 9/11, and we should have, that there could be a heightened state. And should we have done better? I think what she's saying is yes. But I think the danger of the partisan, shrill tone that came out of those hearings. I thought she also went and put out there, not as a point because it would look defensive, but as a question, which is what's the net result of this? And I think it's a really important one. She said, the next time we have a big incident like this, the instinct is going to be to withhold information, to close down, to not share what we know, even in a situation in which that information is evolving and changing. And anyone who's covered any act of terrorism, you know, it's all over the map in the first few days. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the truth is. Right. No one knows what the truth is. And so you get bits of information that are like broken shards of glass that are scattered out into the public. And what this Republican leadership has done is tried to seize on that chaos and call it a failure. And I think she posed an important aspect of why is this worrisome? That would be closing off information. Yeah. The one she didn't talk about but was implicit that I think is extremely important is it would also mean that ambassadors – like Stevens, who I knew, who was amazing, who was someone who took risks. These guys, the great ambassadors, Ryan Crocker, Chris Stevens, take risks. They are very much akin to the military in the sense of wanting to be out there. They're frustrated by the fortress America that keeps them locked in the embassies. That's another danger in this really shrill partisan environment, that if you go too far with Benghazi – and, you know, you're going to end up changing some culture of openness and of risk-taking, both of which I think are really important in a great State Department.
Talking to Charlie Sennett from Global Post and Juliet Kayyem, who's the National Security and Foreign Policy columnist for the Boston Globe. On that point, Juliet, people were talking afterwards how Hillary Clinton was kind of saying, well, they don't really think of our diplomatic people as being in danger the same way our military people are. But then she started – right in the beginning, she started ticking off all the attacks we've had on various embassies and ships, you know, from Tanzania to Kenya to, of course, Libya. She went through – she said there were 19, too numerous since 1988, too numerous. But I thought that was a good point. You think of diplomatic people as being immune. We think of them as our Washington diplomats. No one would attack them. They wouldn't even give a parking ticket for heaven's sake.
Right, with their pashminas and cocktail parties. Yeah. It is so untrue. I mean, actually, you know, in the history of al-Qaeda, and the threats that we have faced, it didn't begin on 9/11. Remember, it began with the African embassy bombings that were clearly, this is what got me into the field because I was at the Department of Justice at the time, that were clearly, that were planned by this guy named Bin Laden that no one had ever heard of. So they have been a target for forever.
And that was 1988? When was that?
Yeah, 98.
98. Okay.
So, that was aging me. And so So I think that that's important to remember, that they have always been targets. And I think the point that she was making about the future is with an approach to foreign affairs that Obama barely spoke of the day before, or at the inauguration 2 days before, but an approach in which we are minimizing our military footprint, maximizing other footprints or other nation footprints, that is going to expose our diplomats even further. So this was a plea for that, you know, to the extent that you don't want the military footprint, there's going to be others. If you want America engaged, conscious, you know, helpful, whatever we can be, then they're going to be at risk. And this point that Charlie was so important is, I always quote, you know, in the middle of a crisis, whether it's emergency management, homeland security, counterterrorism, the true story is often not known for months or years. This was true of the Columbine killers, which we had an image of them for years until Enterprising Reporter comes out and says, wait, they actually had friends. They weren't goth. I mean, and think about even Hurricane Katrina, right? We all go to bed that night being told the levees hold. The administration at that time goes on air and says, horrible event, but dodged a bullet. And then, you know, why did it take 14 hours? Well, that's the nature of information, right? You have to be validated and deterred. So I thought that – I think that point about information in a crisis, if we're always in a crisis, let's be sympathetic that information will change.
Well, then on that, Charlie, was Ambassador Susan Rice an unnecessary scapegoat? I mean, we're going to hear a lot more about this this afternoon when the House takes over the questioning.
I mean, if we thought the Senate was tough, the House is going to be a zoo in comparison. But I think that I do think that President Obama has a weakness, which is that he likes his favorite people inside that administration. He was trying to put one of them forward in Ambassador Rice. She wasn't prepared. She had nowhere near the credentials of Senator Kerry. They were trying to position her politically. And, you know, I think that failed. And I think that's one of the great, marvelous things about a democracy is she went out, she made a mistake, and she got pummeled, and the administration got pummeled for it, and rightly so. She didn't present the information accurately, even though much of it was classified. And I thought she has every reason to say, look, that was classified, and I was given these talking points, and as a member of an administration, that's what you do. But you need to be more than that. You need to be wise. You need to understand that information's early. You need to stress that point more. She didn't know that. She got burned for it. The biggest takeaway I take from the hearings today, though, is when Hillary talked about we are in a whole new place, that what the attack in Benghazi, what the attack, you know, and the situation in Algeria and Mali, the attacks in Nigeria, the threats in Nigeria, all of them show that al-Qaeda has morphed and changed. And the idea of a big, spectacular attack is changing into these sporadic, isolated attacks all around the world, and particularly in Africa. So if we're going to have that truth, I thought that Secretary of State Clinton did a great job of turning the tables and saying, as Julia pointed out, you know, I need your help. Yeah. I need you to help me now to get so that we can have a stronger State Department. Pass that budget. Let's start working together. Let's start figuring out, because after all, if you want government, that takes money. And if you keep cutting everything, yeah, we're going to jeopardize our security. That's also a really legitimate thing. And I thought the several senators, Secretary of State Clinton never went here, but several of them said, if you want to throw stones at glass houses on Benghazi, let's talk about inaccurate information in the context of the war in Iraq. Let's talk about the culpability of putting out what we now know very clearly was false information about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And let's talk about the tragedy of 4,000 lives lost in the war in Iraq. I think that's a resonant point, and I think that's going to silence the Republicans. And if anyone on the Hill is smart, if anyone in the House is going to be smart about the next round of questioning, I think that's going to come up again, and there's going to be a lot of fireworks. No, she won't, but the Democrats that committee will.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe the Democratic senators went there. I mean, they have every right to go there on Iraq, but it was clearly, I think it was an anticipation of a much more heated exchange than I think what we saw, even with McCain and Rand. I was expecting, let's wait for the House, but in the Senate, I was even expecting
more cordial.
And it's just, and so this is just a very interesting dynamic, you know, and the personalities all came out. But I think overall, Clinton looked sober, serious,
absolutely,
and ready to do four more years as Secretary of State if she wanted to. I mean, but clearly has other things in mind.
All right. We've been talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's testimony on Benghazi with Juliet Kayyem of the Kennedy School. She's also the national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe. Juliet, thank you as always for checking in with us.
Thank you so much.
All right. We're also talking to Charlie Sennett from Global Post, and we're going to stick around and talk about a new project that the Global Post is undertaking called The Great Divide. I was on your page today, Charlie, kind of money. I just got, because I was listening to Benghazi, it was kind of hard to take on two major.
What's really going to be fun. I think you can turn the corner from Benghazi to income inequality in this country and taxation and a shrinking budget in a time of shrinking resources. There is a transition I think we can make.
Okay, well, go ahead. This is actually a fascinating project. I mean, it's global. It's the United States, actually. It's looking at the economic divide in the United States.
The idea was to pay attention to an issue that President Obama had right in the middle of his inaugural address, which was that we can't have a country where a few get richer and richer and many, many more are getting poorer and poorer. It's pulling the country apart. Middle class is collapsing as a result. This was really one of the great heart and soul issues of this election, that we had in the candidate Republican Romney, we had an embodiment of those who have made vast wealth on the financial manipulations of a tax code in which he paid 15% or less taxes And there are so many others, myself and I'm sure you included as well, were paying well into
39.
The 30s.
Yeah.
So there you have an inequality that is set up structurally within our government that has created, as every bit of data indicates, a dramatic separation between the very wealthy and the poor in this country and a collapsing middle class. You know, when you Americans walk around thinking that this is still the land of the American dream, and I hope it always will be, but the facts speak otherwise, that with rising income inequality comes shrinking mobility. It is statistically harder and harder to travel from the lower rungs of the economy to the upper rungs. So hard data to get your head around. It's a complicated project, but I think it's a great project in which what we tried to do was say to Americans, look, income inequality in this country is a huge issue. So let's show you reflective comparisons and hold a mirror up to America. So when you look at the data for the gap between rich and poor in a place like Connecticut, where you have a crumbling industrial city like Bridgeport, mm-hmm. right up against Greenwich, Connecticut, where we have so many of the hedge funds that produce this vast wealth, you compare that data, that distance compares to Bangkok, Thailand, a country we think of as the height of the third world with poor slums and a rich elite. And I think Americans need to start to look at themselves in the mirror that way and see that if we're not careful, income inequality can pull this country apart so far that we begin to reflect the third world more than that dream we were all raised on, that you have the opportunity here to move up. So, you know, it's a big, complicated project, but I really would love people to go. The Great Divide, it's at globalpost.com. When you're on the site, we have an interactive map where you can compare your metropolitan area in America and see what it compares to statistically for inequality in the world. So if you're from Selma, Alabama, and you click on, you're going to see that you statistically compare to Rio. If you're from Greenwich, Connecticut, or Fairfield County, Connecticut, you're going to see you compare to Bangkok. If you're from Washington, D.C., you compare to Moscow. And it's a very interesting way for us to look at places.
What is Boston?
So Boston's comparisons. Boston's one of those places that has high inequality. New England, the New England states, Massachusetts included, are very high on economic inequality because we have great wealth from great businesses.
All the coastal states, I would guess.
That have developed wonderful companies like Genzyme and others where shareholders are making a lot of money. But do we have those working class industrial jobs that made us more a place where we had a greater sense of equality, that there was wealth and there was the middle class and there was a lower class? We've lost that middle class, particularly in New England and all of the industrial sectors. So we have great wealth for people with great education, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But we also have an underclass that's drifting further and further away from those of wealth. And what is that? What is the social cost of that? And that's one of the big things that we tried to look at in this series.
Well, I mean, you know, as you know, the great economist Milton Friedman would have said, well, this is the free market, and it will correct. All things are self-correcting. Do you not believe that?
Well, I think all things are self-correcting, but government has actively developed a tax code that has favored the wealthy. Yeah. And that has created inequality. So things are about to be corrected. If this president is successful, as he laid out in his inaugural.
Tax code pretty well hammers the middle class, too. That new tax code. Have you looked at your paycheck?
Yeah.
I was stunned.
Yeah. The interim steps that have been taken aren't where this administration wants to go. The question is, can this administration effectively work with Congress to change the tax code, to begin to turn this back? Remember, it took 25, 30 years to get to the point where we are. What I don't believe in is this sense that, like, politics is like Doppler weather, that you just have to watch where it's going to go. There's been an active mm-hmm. lobby working on behalf of people who make their money through hedge funds and large corporations that don't want to pay big taxes. And they've worked hard to make it that way. It's going to be a lot harder to get people of the middle class or people who care who are wealthy or people in the lower class to realize that tax structure has created inequality. And I do think it's an issue we need to care about. It's not one of these lefty, wonky issues mm-hmm. you don't need to worry about. There's a social cost to greater inequality, and that is we've got to have mobility in this country. If the American dream becomes so brittle it breaks and it's forgotten, that hurts our country. And all the economists we've talked to from the left and the right talk about how this is an issue to really think about. How you address it is where you get a split left and right. but the fact that it's a problem is agreed upon. So the intention of this special report...
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you do with this information?
...is to say, let's get educated about it first. The first thing to recognizing something needs to be fixed is to understanding it's broken. And I think that's what we hoped to do in the Great Divide on Global Post. Go to the map, look at this level of inequality. Look at the fact that the London School of Economics did what's called a longitudinal study to understand mobility, how people move from the lower rungs to the upper rungs. You have to look at it long term. You have to analyze the data long term. London School of Economics did this with the 10 most industrialized countries in the world. Where do you think the United States ranks in terms of mobility for people to be able to rise up out of 10?
Just, 10th.
Good guess. So you mean, you know, England is ahead of us, Germany is ahead of us, all of the Scandinavian states are ahead of us. This is...
We have peculiar problems that the Scandinavian states do not have.
Well,
and others.
But we, you ask the average American, where is the place in the world you want to live if you want to become educated and have equal opportunity to get rich?
Not Sweden.
They're not going to say Sweden or Germany because they're going to think those are like class-oriented old Europe. If America wants to keep alive what made it great, which is the American dream, it's got to analyze this inequality and say, have we blown it? Have we lost the American dream?
We have immigration issues that some of the countries you just mentioned do not have.
Well, the United Kingdom.
What's going to happen with that?
Within this country?
Yeah, but it's different. It's a different immigrant population.
Well, you mean what is going to happen with a largely uneducated immigrant class that continues to come in and take those jobs, service sector jobs that are in the lower rungs? It's a great question. I think, this is why God bless our elected officials. These are hard questions, and I think anyone who's trying to work them through is great.
You look at the industry that, in Europe and England, that the people coming in from Pakistan and India, I mean, these people come in with a mission. You know, some of them already have sort of like a ground, toehold, in restaurants or whatever it is.
But the same is true here. I mean, the immigrants who come into this country also come into jobs with landscaping companies, with construction companies. So what we did, the comparison for migrants in this series, what we did is we looked at metropolitan areas in America and what country equated with the inequality statistics. Metropolitan LA, which has a great problem with immigration, compares to China, which also has a very serious problem in Beijing with migration. Poor Chinese laborers coming from the hinterlands into Beijing to take those jobs, and in some cases being pushed into the city to fulfill these lower level jobs. So China last week, for the first time in its history, released its data on income inequality, and it's through the roof. It's much higher than we thought.
Did you
in
believe
our series.
It? I don't believe anything they released.
The question is, no, I don't believe it, but it's probably higher than they're saying. What they're saying is income inequality is high, but it's actually higher.
Yeah, I'm sure it's higher.
By the way, the LA data is probably masking a lot of the immigrant data that we're not getting
our head around.
So ours is probably higher, too. Mm-hmm. Our inequality is probably higher as well. Data's tough, but in this case, LA and Beijing compare, and one of the core issues we look at in the Great Divide is migration and immigration and how that feeds into this inequality that we need to all think about.
All right. Charlie Sennett, he's the vice president and editor of Global Post, talking about the Great Divide, a new project on the Global Post website. I checked it out today. It's very interesting. Thanks, Charlie, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's testimony as well. All right. Coming up, there is a new sheriff in town. The man replacing outgoing Suffolk County Sheriff Andrea Cabral has folks saying the appointment smells like patronage. And guess what? Patrick agrees. He says it is. What's wrong with that? All right. I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.